Good morning, Northwood. Good morning. It is a privilege to be with you this morning. If you came to hear Bob Roberts and you think he kind of went this way and this way, I'm not Bob. My name is Keith Tower. It's a pleasure to be with you. And at 7 feet tall, I'm guessing I'm the tallest guy that's ever stood up here on this platform. So, and if the rest of your staff looks anything like Brian Hook, I'm the most handsome man that's ever stepped on this platform. But it's a real pleasure to be with you this morning. I don't often leave my church back in Orlando, but when Bob Roberts called and had an opportunity to come here and be with Northwood, I jumped at the chance. Because this is a church that I've admired from a distance for many years. And the past 3 years got to know Brian, the past year got to know Bob. And I love this church. My first time here, but I'm very excited about what God's doing here. And if you ever wonder if God loves you, all you need to do is look at the community of faith that he's placed you in. If you ever wonder if God loves you or is looking out for you, all you need to do is look around you at the leaders that God has given you to watch over your soul. And I can tell you, he thinks the world of you. So it's a real pleasure to be here with you. You know, I played 7 years in the professional basketball, and I was always one of those guys that could make the most of a moment. I didn't always play a lot when I was with Orlando. I played the same position as a teammate of mine. You may have heard of him. His name's Shaquille O'Neal. And while I know it was an agonizing decision every game for the coach, who should start at center tonight? Let's see, Tower, O'Neal, Tower, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. It's weird. Mo always fell on Shaq. But anyway, I didn't get in the games a lot at that point in my career, but I could always figure out how to make the most of a moment. What I mean by that is every team picture, I'm always standing right next to Shaq. You never have to wonder where to find me. I played for the Chicago Bulls for about long enough to have a cup of coffee. Team photo, guess where I'm standing? Right between Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. You can always find Keith. I knew how to make the most of a moment. And after games, you know, in Orlando at the time, we were a very popular team, not unlike the Mavericks here now. And, you know, we'd walk out and there'd be thousands of fans waiting outside afterward. They'd be behind the fence and behind the police line and they're cheering. And again, with the ability to make the most of a moment, I would always walk out with Shaq. And it was amazing. We'd walk out and the place would go crazy. Thousands of people screaming for me. Big fella, you hear them, they love me. And I'll never forget one time I was walking out with Shaq. Place is going crazy. And this little boy, not much older than Samuel, managed to sneak through kind of the police line. And he ran up right to Shaq and I. And this, you know, it didn't happen all the time, but usually people were asking Shaq for his autograph. And this kid came running up, and I go, oh, here's another one. And he stopped in front of me. Like, yeah, right. So he stops in front of me, and he reaches, and he has a Sharpie, and he hands me something and goes, would you sign this for me? I'm like, sure. So I take it, and I go to sign it, and it's a basketball card with my picture on it. Now, my whole life growing up, I'd collected cards. Baseball, basketball, football, you name it. And finally, here I am on my own card. So I sign it, and I put it in my back pocket. And look, I gave the kid his card back, okay? I gave him his card back, but I went home, and I told my wife, I'm like, I go crashing through the doors. I got home. I'm like, honey, you're not going to believe it. I've arrived. She goes, I can see that. I said, no. I mean, I've arrived. In my basketball career, I spent my whole life trying to get on a card, finally trying to become somebody, and now this card company has validated me. I've arrived. I'm on my own basketball card. My wife's not super impressed with me, although she's amazing. She's like, great. What'd you like for dinner? So anyway, but she does love me, and the next morning, I went off to practice, and bless her heart, she went down to the local card shop, and she walked into the card shop, and you know, she doesn't know a ton about sports, so she went, you know, right over to the high rent district, you know, over here under glass with, there's Mickey Mantle and there's Michael Jordan and Babe Ruth, and she's down there looking for me. So the guy behind the desk said, can I help you? And she said, yes, I'm looking for a very special card. And he's thinking, I'm closing early today. Cha-ching. He walks down and says, well, how can I help you? What are you looking for? She said, I'm looking for a Keith Tower card. The guy said, who? She said, Keith Tower. He said, well, what sport does he play? And she goes, dude. My wife calls people dude sometimes, but she goes, dude, he plays for the Orlando Magic. You know, big white guy sits at the end of the bench? So the guy sits back and thinks for a second and goes, Keith Tower, okay. He goes over to his counter, and he goes down underneath it, and he pulls out this old, beat-up, wet cardboard box, just nasty, full of stuff and cards, and it says 5 cents each on it. And he goes, oh, he's probably in there. Bless my heart. My wife went through every single card in the box and found 10 of me. Now, I know what you're thinking, and you're right. I was the most popular guy in the box. So she finds 10 of me at 5 cents a piece, goes up to the counter, lays them all out, and starts fumbling through her pennies and nickels. And the guy looks at this pathetic scene and goes, you know, you can just have those for free. So I went worth being 5 cents to zero, like that. Although I heard their autographed ones are trading for 2 cents on eBay right now, so get them while they're hot. But you know what's fascinating is I spent my entire life, 20 years plus years up until that point, working, sweating, persevering, getting barked at by coaches, having dad think one way of me and the other way, depending on how my performance was, putting everything I had into this thing, into finally arriving. And when I arrived, you know what I found out? It was actually, literally, worth nothing. I'm excited to be kicking off this series called Identity Theft because there are fewer things in our culture that get more attention right now. Identity theft is the fastest growing crime in America. It's a $53 billion annual industry. They say last year alone, 300 million man hours were spent just fixing problems created by identities being stolen. And you and I both know we work so hard to keep our identities safe and secure. How many of us shred bank statements and shred anything that has a social security number on it? And we guard our PIN numbers and we do so much to keep our numbers secure because identity theft is such a big problem. And while that's good, the real problem is those are just numbers. And we don't guard the core true identity of who we are. None of us would ever think of walking up to a random stranger and go, hey, let me tell you my social security number and my bank account number. We'd never do it. Yet we take the core of who we are, the identity that God has created in us, and we entrust it to such fragile and unpredictable things as I am what I do, or I really am those things that I can control, or I am at the core of who I am what somebody says that I am. If you've been involved in sports, you know how common that can be. You play great and everybody loves you. You have a bad game and everybody hates you. I literally was playing for the Orlando Magic, and we used to have a thing where if we scored 110 points and won, everybody in the arena would get a free Big Mac. And we were at about 107 points, and the coach checked me in towards the end of the game. And we got to 108. And then there was about four or five, 6 seconds left, and the place is going crazy because they want a free Big Mac. And I got the ball, and I got fouled. I have 2 free throws for 21,000 ravenous fans to get a free Big Mac. And I stepped up to the line for my first free throw, and I hit it, and the place is going absolutely bananas. I am the hero of all of Central Florida with 1 free throw to go. And I can tell you, I've played in the NBA playoffs. I've been in the NCAA tournament. I've played for a state title. And I've never been more nervous in an athletic event ever in my life. And I stepped up, and I missed. And I had 21,000 people go from loving me to hating me in a second. I am walking through the tunnel, and they are cursing me, my mom, my wife, my baby, you name it, my dog. And I went home and felt terrible. You know, if you've been involved in sports, how you can go up and down based on your performance. And it's not just, well, I played well, I didn't play well. It's like, I'm good, I'm bad. Maybe sports aren't your thing and you can't relate to that. Maybe you find yourself as a businessman, and you've worked so hard, and you've built a reputation, and you've made deals, and man, you just drew such a sense of significance from that. Man, I've arrived. I have my name on the office door. And then this strange thing happens in 2008, 2009, the economy starts shaking. And while you drew strength and a sense of identity from what you could accomplish, now you're in this weird spot of, I used to be a businessman, I used to be the person that could help others, now I find myself without a job and needing help from others. Who am I? Maybe that's not your situation. Maybe you haven't even started a work life yet. Maybe you're a student. And you've been plugging along, trying to get good grades, and you know that if you can just get straight A's, if you can just get into that college, then you'll be validated. Or maybe that's not where you're striving this morning if you're a student. Maybe you're one of those folks that everybody's identified. Oh, you're the sporty kid. Oh, you're the shy kid. Oh, you're the funny one. And you want people to know who you are, but you kind of don't. Because if you can be the funny one, all you have to do is be funny. And if people don't like you, well, they just don't like the funny guy. That's okay. It doesn't touch you. But at the same time, you're dying for people to know because you know you're more than funny or more than shy or more than what other people say you are. Maybe you're in here and you're a new mom. And you used to be known by who you were as a daughter under your parents, then who you were as a young adult, then who you were as a spouse. And now all of a sudden, you are looking and going, I'm not totally sure who I am, but I know I'm a mom. And you're drawing your identity from who you are as a mom, and you feel validated by how your kids behave. Who knows, it's risky and fragile if the core of who you are rests on whether your three-year-old is going to act like they're 15. And they throw peas, and all of a sudden, I'm a failure. And the core of your identity just shakes and rocks based on what your kids do. Maybe you're sitting in here, and you're not any of those. Maybe you're a single person, and you're looking to change your identity. Man, if I could just be a wife. If I could just get me a man, if I could just have a boyfriend, if I could just have a girlfriend, if I could just be known not just by who I am, but who I'm connected to, and you will do almost anything to keep that relationship going. You'll compromise the core of who you are to try to have that identity changed and be connected. Can anybody relate with me this morning? That was a question. Okay. Sorry. You know, it's not just in worldly pursuits that we have some challenges with giving away our identity or having it robbed. It can be in spiritual things. Maybe you're going, you know, if I could just pray more, if I could just preach like Brian Hook, if I could just read my Bible more, if I could just get more Tea Life cells, if I just attended church more, if I just went on more missions trip, if I just served more, if I just did, then finally, God, who I know is waiting to put his stamp of approval on me, but can't because I'm not doing enough. If I could do a little bit more, then I would finally arrive. Then I'd have my identity. Truth is, we all know this treadmill. We're all on it, or have been at some point in time. It's common to every single one of us. It's so common. In fact, this idea of our identity getting wrapped up in who we are or what people say, that Jesus addressed it among the last things he said while he walked this earth. In John chapter 17, it's Jesus' longest recorded prayer. And it is literally the night after the Last Supper prior to dying on the cross. There were a lot of things that Jesus could pray. Who assumes that the last things he said and the last things he prayed are probably pretty important? I don't think at that point he was taking a grocery list, right? He's talking to the Father. He's in anguish. And he's crying out certain things. And he's going, oh, God, let this be so. Raise your hand if you think Jesus got his prayers answered. Yes, he did. The Father heard him. And in John chapter 17, he addresses this issue of identity that we all wrestle with. Who are we? We'll pick it up in John 17, verse 20 through 26. Jesus said, I do not pray for these alone, referring to his immediate followers that are right next to him, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. That's you and me. that they may be one, as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. And the glory which you gave me, I have given them, that they may be one just as we are one, I in them and you in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that you have sent me. Listen to this. And have loved them as you've loved me. Remember that. Father, I desire that they also, whom you gave me, may be with me where I am, that they may behold my glory which you've given me. Remember this one. For you loved me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, the world has not known you, but I've known you, and these have known that you sent me. And I declared to them your name, and I will declare it, that the love with which you love me may be in them, and I in them. There are two massively important concepts that we get here. And I ask you to remember them both. Jesus says he's praying to God about you and I. And he says, you love them the same way that you love me. Does anybody in here think that God the Father loves God the Son without limits, is for him and never against him? Would you agree with that? He says, the same way, meaning of the same essence, to the same breadth, to the same depth, to the same degree, of the very same essence that you love me, love them. That's staggering. But then he goes a step further and he goes, you loved me before the foundations of the earth. Don't miss this. God the Father loves you in the same way that he loves Christ, which, while being without limits, was also before the foundations of the earth. Which means before time and space got created, before your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were alive, God the Father made a choice to love you in the same manner that he loved his Son. Staggering. Because if we understand the implications of this, that God loves you, and he loved you in the same way that he loves Christ, and he chose to do so before the foundations of the earth, then guess what? God's love for you is not dependent on anything you do. Think about this. If he loved you before you were even around, then there's not something you can do now that makes him love you more. If he loved you before you came along and screwed your life up, guess what? He already chose to love you. If you walked in here for the first time and you're going, I don't know who God is, guess what? He still loves you. He loves you of the same essence that he loves Christ, and he loved you before the foundations of the earth. So as we're looking at this idea of identity, here's what I want you to get. If you're a note taker, write this down. If you're not, I'll say it about 15 times before we're done. Because if you walk out of here and you get nothing else out of what I say, please get this. Highlight, bold, underline. Our identity is determined by God's love, not our performance. Our identity is determined by God's love, not by our performance, but because before we ever did anything to become something, he already chose us to love us. The implications of this are staggering. For one thing, it means that he loves you before you get everything right, before you have it all figured out, before you've done anything to really impress him, before you do anything or before you have it all figured out, he's already chosen to love you. When I was playing with Orlando, I'll never forget my first day in the NBA. Literally, my first day, my first practice, my first drill. I was excited about being down with Orlando. I had signed a contract that became good and active if I made the team. And again, there was another center that was already there, Shaquille O'Neal. If you think I'm big, he's about this much taller than I am. His shoulders are about this much wider, and his booty is that big. And when he puts it on you, he'll hurt a brother, okay? And the very first drill went something like this. We broke up, and the guards went, did whatever little guys do. And then us big guys came down to this end, and we played basketball. And I'm sorry if you're a guard. I hate guards almost as much as refs, but that's okay. All right, imagine the basket's right here. Here's how the drill goes. The basket's right here. We see it? Woo. Okay, basket's there. About 3 feet in front of it, just outside of the key, stands one guy on offense. Right here, what's your name, friend? Mark? Mark, your coach. Mark's got the ball. Okay, the drill goes like this. He throws the ball into, at this point, Shaq, and somebody stands in what we call the torture chamber, which is between Shaq and the basket. And the coach says, you have to stay on the court until you stop him. So in other words, if Shaq scores, we throw the ball out to Mark, we reset it, and we go again. You guys following me? All right, so Shaq posts up on offense. I decide, man, I'm going to guard him, so I go out here on defense because, man, my road to the NBA goes right through Shaquille O'Neal. I was stupid. Okay, so anyway, so Shaq posts up here on offense. I'm down here on defense. Man, I'm pushing on him. I'm playing my best D. They throw it into Shaq, and he turns to go up. And I jumped as high as I could thinking I'm going to block him. And if you have ESPN Classic, you know that doesn't happen. Boom, he dunked it. The ball literally came through, hit me on top of the head, and dazed me for a second. The coach says, I have to stay out here till I stop him. So we throw it back out to coach. He throws it in a second time. This time Shaq goes up. This time I went way up to block it. And Shaq goes way, way up. Boom, dunks it again. Three times. Boom, four. Boom, five times in a row. My first drill in the NBA, Shaquille O'Neal dunks it on my head. We get to like the sixth time and I'm starting to get half bleary, half wising up. And I recall that the coach said I had to stop him, but he didn't say how. So I'm like, I'm fouling this dude, right? So they throw it into Shaq and he turns to go up. And I wound up with one hand as hard as I could. And I chopped down as he was going up and I swing down and boom, dunks on me again. I'm glad you enjoy my misery. So I'm going, man, the one-hander didn't work. I'm chopping him with two hands. So they throw it in. He turns to go up. It's almost like I'm swinging an axe. I swing down as hard as I can. Boom, dunks again. We're on like the eighth time, getting a little bit desperate. Thinking, man, what did I get into? But you know what? I went to Notre Dame, football school. I'm tackling this guy. So Shaq posts up again, and this time I'm not here. I'm down like this, right? I mean, I'd have made Mac Brown proud, right? So they throw it in. Shaq turns to go up, and I stepped in. It was picture perfect. I step in to tackle him, and my shoulder hit his shoulder as he's turning, and I'm stepping in. And I have a big shoulder, but his shoulder's like the front of a bus. And I'm trying to tackle him, but somehow I end up, I kid you not, laying flat on my back. I don't know how it happened. I'm the one on the ground. He dunks it, and the ball came through the net so hard it hit me in the chest and knocked the wind out of me. So I peel myself up off the floor, cough up a lung, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I'm going to tell you what I did, because I'm resourceful. They threw it into Shaq for like the 10th time, and I'm a little bit desperate, to say the least. He turns to go up, and I jumped on his back. I have my legs wrapped around his waist. I've got him around the neck, and I'm choking him. I'm squeezing as hard as I can. He goes up, and he missed. So I go strutting over to grab some water. Yeah, baby, I stopped Shaq. That's right. I actually didn't do that. I walked over to get a drink of Gatorade, and I thought, I am going to get cut. This is my first day, and they're going to send me home. We have two-a-days. If they let me survive this practice, they won't invite me back tonight. And sure enough, they actually did. And I made it through the first week. And they bring in like 15 guys into training camp. They pare it down to 12. And I see the first guys starting to get cut. And about 2 or 3 weeks go by, and I look around, and I kind of do the math, and I'm one of only 12 guys left. I realized I made the team. I'll never forget this. The day before our first game, the coach brings every player in individually and tells them their role on the team. Shaq, your job's to score 30 points a game. Tower, your job's to get dunked on in practice. Whatever. And coach sat me down. He said, you know, told me my role on the team. And then he stood up and he shook my hand. He said, welcome to the NBA. I said, coach, thank you so much. I'm a little bit puzzled, though. He said, well, what's the matter? I said, I don't know if you remember this. And if you don't, I can't believe I'm reminding you. But I said, you remember that first day of practice, coach? You remember this? I said, that was the single most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to me on the basketball court. How in the world did I make this team? And I'll never forget his words. He looked at me and goes, most embarrassing, huh? He said, that's one way to look at it. He said, actually, I watched that drill intensely, and while you found it embarrassing, that's the moment that I decided you were going to be on this team. I said, Coach, I don't get it. What are you talking about? He said, listen, no one can stop Shaq. Nobody has. Nobody will. I can teach you how to do that. But I know that you're the kind of man that will stay in the fight. You've got heart. I'll teach you the other stuff. And I want to encourage you this morning, if you're just getting started on this God journey and you don't have everything figured out yet, you don't have your PhD in theology yet, you haven't led a T-Life cell group yet, you can't sing like Brent, which who can? And maybe you're trying to figure out and you're wondering, oh God, if I could just do everything perfect, would you finally put your seal on me? Let me tell you something, you're already a chosen man. You're already a chosen woman. He's already made his decision. Well, I'm fumbling around embarrassing myself in my Christianity. This can't be right. Really? Because the God I know loves you like he loves Jesus, and that was before the foundations of the earth. You might be sitting here this morning going, oh, Keith, that's great. Are we talking about cheap grace this morning? No, we're not. We're talking about very expensive grace. But you don't have to pay for it. It's on somebody else's tab. So quit trying to earn it. You can't afford it. You guys still like me? Our identity is determined by God's love, not by our performance. Maybe you're on the other side of the spectrum, impressing God with how much good you can do. It's not that you're not doing anything. It's that you're doing everything. And you just know that you're God's favorite son because... look at these guys next to you that don't serve as much as you. You're feeling just awesome about that. And every so often you pull out your resume and remind God how amazing you are. Jesus addressed something like that. It's fascinating. He said in Matthew 7, verse 22, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles? Then I'll tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. Lord, Lord, look at all this great stuff I did. As if God is some teenager that can be manipulated. Like he's sitting up there going, oh, you know, hey, do enough good stuff and then maybe I'll like you. He doesn't pull the strings that way. He never relates to us based on our resume. It's always based on our relationship. Oh, and by the way, unless you've walked on water, unless you've spoken and a universe popped out, your resume is not that impressive to him. So put it away, because before you ever did any of those really cool things, guess what? He already chose you. And before you ever did amazing stuff that you know he's so impressed with, he made a decision before the foundations of the earth. Put it away. Relax. Let him love you. Our identity is always determined by God's love, not by our performance. Here's one last kind of implication of this concept is, God's love doesn't diminish when we mess up. Who knows, that's a good thing, because sometimes pastors mess up and sometimes non-pastors mess up. And God's love never diminishes, even if we do. A good friend of mine, one of the most influential people in my life, he's a pastor and spent a lot of time giving stuff away. He's got a large family, 7 kids. So they've always had a big honking, you know, 15-passenger kind of plain, you know, white van. And one day he and his wife decided the kids were starting to get a little bit older that he should at least have a car that he liked. So he went and bought a very cool one-person drivable BMW that was just his. They still had their big family meat wagon, but he had his own car. And he loved it. And he had it for all of about 2 weeks. And his kids were outside in the driveway drawing with sidewalk chalk. Amazing family, amazing man. They're drawing all kinds of stuff and whatever with sidewalk chalk. And his youngest son, who's about 4 at the time, 3 maybe, 4 probably, I guess, came in and said, Dad, I want you to see what I drew for you. He said, okay, son, I'll be right out. His older son came in about a minute later and said, "Dad, I want you to come see what Grant drew for you." I said, "Oh, okay. I'll be right out." And he walked out, and there are murals all up and down their driveway. They were amazing. And he's like, "Oh, this is so great. Grant, which one is yours?" And he goes, "Well, Dad, I didn't draw mine here. I wanted you to be able to take mine with you." He goes, "What does that mean?" He walks him over to the side of his two-week-old BMW. Don't worry, it wasn't in chalk. It was scratched with a stone. This amazing mural on the driver's side door. And his son's going, "Dad, look, here's the sun up here, scratched in with a sharp rock. Here's a tree. And look, Dad, here's you." And there's a little, you know, a stick man with a little arrow, and it says "Dad" in three-year-old writing. And he goes, "And Dad, there's me, little stick man with an arrow." And he goes, "But I didn't know how to spell Grant to write my name on it." So my friend got down on his knees and grabbed his son and said, "Son, I love that. Let me see your hand." Still holding the sharp rock. G-R-A-N-T. Underline, underline, star by it. So they know you're the star of this, son. Here's the reality, guys. We mess stuff up. You and I are doing our best to make a pretty picture out of our life for God. We're trying to impress him, but you just might scratch something you shouldn't. And God's love does not diminish based on that. You don't cease to become his son or his daughter. That issue was settled long before we ever messed it up. Grant is his son. Our identity is determined by God's love, not by our performance. So what is your identity? Who are you? You're a son or daughter. You're a deeply loved and cherished son or daughter. You're an heir to the King of the universe. Just from Ephesians alone, I was reading this morning in Ephesians 1 chapter, it says we're chosen, we're blameless, we're adopted, we're accepted, we're forgiven, we're predestined, we're sealed. And by the way, you didn't do any of those. That is who you are, based on God's great love for us. We're the apple of his eye. Do I have time for one short story, or do you want me to stop? Okay. I was playing for the Milwaukee Bucks, and there's this great big man store in Philadelphia. Every pro sports team that goes through Philadelphia stops in this place called Boyd's because they have the best stuff. Sometimes big and tall means big and goofy, but not at Boyd's. It's really nice stuff. So I was playing in Milwaukee. We flew to Boyd's, and I got several suits. We always needed to wear a suit in Milwaukee, and so I got a bunch of them at Boyd's. I had a great tailor back in Milwaukee. So I went to Boyd's. I wear a 54 jacket, which a 54 jacket also comes out to here. So a 38 pant and 54 jacket, they've got to do some tailoring, to say the least. So I got a couple nice suits, and they said, "Would you like us to tailor?" I said, no, I have a great tailor in Milwaukee. Why don't you just, go ahead and mark it up however you need to, and then I'll take it home and take care of it." So if you've ever had something tailored, they write, a little circle buttonhole over here, and they cut, and they just draw chalk lines all over the thing. Looks like you have tic-tac-toe all over your suit. So I went home. It wasn't a big deal. And I get back. I've got my suits that I'm going to drop at the tailor, and we have a game that night, and I go to my closet, and none of my suits are there. My wife had taken them all to the cleaner. We had to wear a suit to every game, and I don't have one, except for my checkerboard. So I'm going, what the heck? It's Milwaukee. It's like, you know, 4 degrees. I'm going to wear my top coat over it. All that you're going to see is my tie and whatever. So I wear this suit. I have my belt cinched like 4 times around me because the pants are ginormous. So I go in. I go all the way to the locker room. And then I get in the locker room. I'm like, dudes, check me out. And they're laughing at my crazy looking suit. It's a mess. So I start changing into my uniform, and at this point in time, I was the starting center. I had come a long way from my days in Orlando. Starting center for the Milwaukee Bucks, and we had a guy, another good player, who had been injured, and he was coming off of injured reserve that night. You can only have 12 guys active. So when a guy comes off of injured reserve, somebody has to, oh, gosh, was that my hamstring? And they pretend an injury, and they become inactive. Well, we were laughing all morning at our morning practice. Wonder who's going to have to get hurt, whose back's hurting, you know, all that kind of stuff, laughing. I knew it wasn't going to be me, right, because I'm the starting center. So I put on my full game suit. I'm walking out to warm up, and the trainer comes and goes, hey, Keith, coach wants to talk to you, which is trainer for you're going to go on injured reserve. And I'm going, and all the fellas are like, dude. And then all of a sudden, dawns on me, when you're on injured reserve, you don't wear your uniform, you wear your suit. Well, thank God I'm in an environment with other 7-footers, right? I'm like, man, bro, can I borrow your suit? No. Guys in the NBA are ruthless. I can't get anybody to help me out with so much as a sport coat. They're hiding their stuff. I'm going to have to go out, be sitting on the bench on TV. So I walk into the coach's office. He goes, Keith, you know Andrew's coming off injured reserve? I said, yeah. I said, yeah, I do, coach. What am I going to wear? First time I've ever asked myself that, and the last, quite honestly. I don't care what I wear, but anyway. He said, yeah, so you know we have to make some space for him. I said, yeah, I do, coach. And he goes, so you're cut from the team. I'm sorry? He said, yeah, you're cut. Clean out your locker and go home. Suddenly I'm thinking, I'd love to wear my checkerboard on your bench tonight. I got up and I said, well, thank you, coach, for the opportunity. I appreciate it. And I walked out of his office. True story. I don't know what your theology is. I don't really care. This is what happened. As I went to shut the door from the coach's office, I heard God tell me this. He said, you will never be cut from my team based on how you play. Because God made me a son, and he's made you a son or daughter, no matter how you're performing at this moment in time. Let me pray for you. Father, thank you for these amazing saints here. God, your love for them is extraordinary. And God, I pray that every dream that the staff has for this identity theft series would be fulfilled and be realized. And I'm praying, God, if there's any that struggle in here to either impress you, God, or figure they can't engage with you until they get everything right, or maybe they were doing great and somehow tripped up along the way, I pray you would just eradicate that from them right now. And God, you would give all of us the ability to sit and rest in the simple fact that you love us like you love Jesus before the foundations of the earth.